I'm coming again to that section of Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 5 to 20. I know we read it the last time that we were dealing with it, but we only got the length of verse 5. Then we noticed that we wanted to look at the section that we're studying with three main divisions. First of all, there were the ways of the Chaldeans, and especially their leader. It may have been Nebuchadnezzar, or it may have been Belshazzar. But certainly Nebuchadnezzar in the early stages, because he was the leader. He was the great world leader and his kingdom. The Chaldeans and the Babylonians were the world power at that particular time. Now we're looking at this because it was all entailed in the vision that God gave to Habakkuk. Without going back over what we've looked at in the book of Habakkuk, we do need to say this, that Habakkuk had handed the whole matter of his perplexity over to the Lord. And then the Lord began to speak to him in verse 2 of chapter 2. The Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables. Now that vision is what we're looking at in verses 5 to 20 for the most part. And Habakkuk was given it by the Lord. He had to write it down. And it concerned this man and his kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. And we've already noticed the ways of this man. And we're going to look at the works of this man today. And I had planned earlier that we would look at the woes of this man and his people. But it may be unlikely that we'll get that far today. And so we may have to break off abruptly. But let me say that Habakkuk was given this vision that was going to have a specific fulfillment, a definite fulfillment, and at a definite time. Notice verse 3 of chapter 2. For the vision, that is what Habakkuk now is writing about in verses 5 onward, for the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie, though it tarry. Wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Now we've already seen verse 5 about the ways of this man, and we noticed then that there was greed and selfishness. There was a haughtiness about the man. Even then there was a drunkenness, and there was this insatiable desire, an appetite that could never be satisfied for power and for status and for wealth. And we dealt with all of that whenever we looked at this last. Now we're going to go down these verses again, only look at them more closely and notice the works of the Chaldeans. And keep in mind that these Chaldeans were the instrument that God was raising up in order to deal with the land of Judah because of its sin and backsliding in the days of Habakkuk. Now the first thing to notice about these works is they were overriding the rights of their neighbors. Notice verse 6. Shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. Here's a man that was making himself powerful by trampling over the rights of others. You remember whenever he looked at chapter 1, verse 6, for lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. This man was a tyrant, Nebuchadnezzar. His kingdom were a tyrannical force, a kingdom of tyranny. And they were setting out, and they were going this way, that way, the other way, and they were invading the smaller countries, and they were conquering them, and they were welding them and forging them into one mighty nation under Nebuchadnezzar himself. And he says that you're increasing that which is not yours. You're lading yourself with thick clay. Commentators are not exactly sure what that means, but some of them take the view that all of this wealth that you're having, it's really only thick clay, and it's going to be an encumbrance to you. Oh, you might exult in it, you might rejoice in it, you may revel in it now, but you're going to find it's like yourself, and that's just what man is. Dust he is, and unto dust he will return again. And so is all the wealth that goes with it. And this is what he's saying here to Nebuchadnezzar. And he goes on to say that you've spoiled many nations, and men were shedding their blood because of the violence of the land and the city. Ladies and gentlemen, let me say, first of all, nations need to take care when they invade other nations for their own lusts and for their own power, that God notices that, and God will hold them to account. And it's important to keep that in mind. We saw what communism did way back generations ago. It just invaded other countries for the sake of lust and power and wealth and status. Now, that is not quite the same as a big nation going into a smaller nation to seek to deliver it from unjust rule if they hold fast to that motive. But still need to take care. Because what can set out for a good motive can easily be lost sight of whenever there is the pursuit of conquest. But let me say this, this equally applies to individuals. And there's a warning here for each one of us that we be careful how we treat the rights of other people. For instance, way back in the book of Exodus, we read in one of the chapters there, it's in chapter 22 and the 5th verse, and a case was supposed. And these were instructions that God was giving through Moses to the children of Israel whenever they went into the land of Canaan to populate it, that they were to make sure that they did not overrule or override the rights of their fellow man, fellow Jews. This is what they were told. Don't you put your beast into the vineyard of another man, that beast can benefit from the feeding. Because if you do that and you're found out, you're going to have to make restitution and give of the best of your own land. The rights of other people were to be respected. And then again, whenever we come to the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 19, we are told specifically, or they're told specifically, that you're not to remove the landmark of your neighbor, whatever his border is and has been set out and it has been marked. You're not to trespass over that. You're not to move it and to move it back a bit in order to give you more land. You're not allowed to do that. And the same thing is said in another part of the book of Deuteronomy. But I want to turn you, I want you to look at me with this, with me at this in Amos chapter 5. Would you turn there just for a moment and read with me two verses, because this will bring home to you how the rights of others, especially the rights of the poor, are to be safeguarded. This was happening in Judah in the days of Amos, chapter 5, verse 11 and 12. For as much, therefore, as your treading is upon the poor, and ye take from him burdens of wheat, ye have built houses of hewn stone, but ye shall not dwell in them. Ye have planted pleasant vineyards, but ye shall not drink wine of them. For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. They afflict the just, they take a bribe, they turn aside the poor in the gate from their right, depriving them of proper judgment, overriding their rights. It can be done by an individual upon another. And God is warning us against it. This was one of the terrible sins, one of the terrible wicked works of Nebuchadnezzar, and God noted it here. And he dealt with it, as we'll see the next time. And he'll deal with it in your case and my case if we trample over the rights of others. But let's move on quickly. There was not only this wicked work of overriding the rights of their neighbors, but there was the wicked work of covetous pursuits. Notice verse 9 here. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consumed shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Covetousness is actually highlighted, exposed, denounced, and warned against in one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet. And this mighty monarch Nebuchadnezzar, on his grand crusade of conquering all the peoples and taking their land, does so because he's driven by the motive of covetousness for himself and for his family. Now, there's nothing wrong in a man, father, husband, wanting the best for his family, and that is good. But at what price? Is the motive right? Is the way right? This man was doing it by covetousness, that he might set his nest on high. Now, in the book of Obadiah, one of those verses, there's only one chapter in the book of Obadiah, verse 4 or verse 5, God warns the people. He says, even though you set your nest up in the stars like the eagle, God will bring you down. There's a pride here, a vanity. And Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, as Habakkuk is now seeing, was a nation of covetous people engaged in covetous pursuits, all to make the man to be boosted in his vanity, his arrogance, and his pride. This is another wicked work. And we'll see how that's dealt with whenever we come back to this again. But there's something else here. There's a third work here that's wicked that is set before us. Let's move on in Habakkuk chapter 2 to verse 12. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Here's the third aspect of their wicked works. Oppression. Expansion at the cost of others. Seeking to make gain by oppression. Notice the wording. Building a town by blood, establishing a city by iniquity. This is similar to the first one we looked at, where there was the treading on the rights of others, overriding their rights. But it's looked at from a different angle. It's now showing the blatant wickedness of this conqueror as he's coming along to reach the pinnacle of world success and power. He would come into this town or this city. He would conquer it. He would put the people to the sword. And any that he left, any that he spurred, and he would have spurred some, they would get on with the rebuilding. And they would establish the city the way that Nebuchadnezzar would want it. But God says it's being established in evil, in iniquity. Again, while there may not be the overriding of the rights of others, we need to take care as individuals that we don't go about seeking to build up our own kingdoms, our own empires, our own status, our own standing, to make ourselves look good in the eyes of the world, but doing it in a way that's contrary to the will of God, contrary to the Christianity we profess, and contrary to God's commandments. It's a danger, friend. You might say, this doesn't concern me. This considers a nation that was about 2,500 years ago ruling the world. That may well be, but the principles that brought that kingdom to the fore, that brought that king to great power, are the principles that people work by, sadly, today. God's people can be tainted every bit as much by the evil as the ungodly can. And we need to keep that in mind. But notice the fourth one of these. this comes down most surely to us without any doubt. Notice verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be in thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land of the city, and of all that dwell therein. The fourth of these works, the promoting of alcohol and its debasing effects. I think I went into this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when we dealt with this matter in verse 5. When I went back into Isaiah 5 and Isaiah chapter 28. But here we have this king, not only his nation being given to drink himself, but promoting it with regard to others. This is what the verse is saying there in verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also. For what these people are doing is, they're promoting alcoholism, they're seeking to influence others to become drunken, and there's the awful effects that follow that, and then there's going to be the inevitable shame. But let me put this to you, friend. And I'm speaking again to young people. Young people, you're going to run up against this sooner or later because your peers are going to say, come on, we'll take a drink of this. It may be a bottle of cheap wine. It may be something else out of a public house. They maybe get an adult to go in and get it for you. And then maybe you go to some secluded spot and taste it. And you know that your mum and dad would be furious if they had any idea where you were and what you were doing. You say, I'll just do it for once. But the pressure's on you, and you've got a wee taste for it. And you mightn't have liked it the first time, but because the pressure's on, don't be afraid, don't be a sissy, don't be a square, you try it again. And then you find that you're trying it more and more, and you've acquired a taste for it. And it's going to lead you to become a drunkard, an alcoholic, as a young man or as a young woman. There are terrible effects of alcoholism, my dear friend, in every town in Northern Ireland and even in the outlying areas. Now, these Chaldeans were such. I'll just refer you for now to Daniel chapter 5 without turning to it. But we learn in Daniel chapter 5 that Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, was on the throne at this particular time, and he had a big do for 1,000 of his lords and ladies. And they were in this great hall. And he sent for the vessels that were God's vessels that were captured by Nebuchadnezzar, his father, from the temple at Jerusalem that was burned to the ground and brought to Babylon. And sacrilegiously he sent for those vessels and poured the liquor into the vessels and they all drank. And we are told that they really drank wine, and they began to praise their gods. We'll be looking at this another time. But judgment followed, and it followed very swiftly. It cost him his kingdom. Young people, it'll cost you your modesty. It'll cost you your virtue. It can cost you your purity. We're not going into the detail. You can read it for yourself here in verses 15 and 16. And not only young people, older people besides, office parties at Christmas time, other functions where sensible men and women would never have been given to the idea of such lewdness and impurity because of the power of alcohol. They lose not only their senses, but they lose much more. And it can affect their families and their homes forever. I plead with you today, ladies and gentlemen, have nothing to do with the consumption of liquor as a social beverage. I'd like you to turn back with me to Proverbs chapter 23 to see what the wise man has to say about it. Proverbs 23, just go down quickly to verse 29. Let's read a few verses. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eye? Here's the answer in verse 30. They that tarry long at the wine. They that go to seek mixed wine. Verse 32. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women, and thine heart shall utter perverse things. This is the awful curse, my dear friend, of alcoholism. It's a disaster. Oh, it's a money-making industry for those who are involved in it. But it will ruin lives. It will ruin homes. And it was going to ruin the mighty kingdom of Babylon and the Chaldeans. Habakkuk sees all of this. God is showing him all of it in this vision that God has given him in response to his prayer. But there's one other matter I want you to notice with regard to the works of this man. Not only his overriding the rights of the neighbors, different nations, not only his covetous pursuits, not only of his seeking to make gain and to expand his kingdom by oppression, not only by promoting alcohol and its debasing effects among other people as well as himself. Notice lastly in verses 18 to 20, his promotion of idolatry. Verse 18, woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver. There is no breath at all in the midst of it. Idol worship. Now, the Chaldeans were basically an idolatrous people. I tell you this, these idols were images. Couldn't do a thing, no life in them. If you want to get an idea of an idol, go back to Psalm 115. There the psalmist says they've got eyes, but they can't see. They've ears, they can't hear. They have lips and tongues, but they can't speak. They're all the shape of humanity, but nothing else could they do. Or maybe the shape, in some instances, of animals. But there was no life in them. And the psalmist says, they that worship them are every bit as foolish as the idols themselves. But here, in this particular nation, there were people that were making these images, and then they were speaking to them, and it was of no count. I mentioned Daniel chapter 5 to you there. If you would go back to that chapter and read it at your leisure, you'll find those opening verses where Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, sent for the wine. The people then, when they became inebriated, when they were filled with the wine, they praised their gods out of the religious cups that were for the Jews, and then they praised their idolatrous gods and wicked images. Idolatry and drunkenness was going together here. Oh, my dear friend, those that are given to idols are teachers of lies, as Habakkuk tells us here. But you say, what's that all got to do with me? Simply this, you and I in this modern enlightened day and age don't make idols and bow down and scrape to them and worship them. We don't do that. But we can be as guilty of idolatry as the ignorant, savage and heathen. How? Anything or anybody that occupies the affection and the devotion in our lives that God should have, that is an idol. That which you spend most of your time in, that which you give your love and allegiance and thought to, if it's taken the place of God, that's an idol. It may be a pastime. It may be a career. It may be a business. It may be a relationship. It may be a hobby. Things that are perfectly all right in themselves. But because of the inordinate amount of time, the excessive amounts of thought and time and devotion, that the Lord is banished right out of the picture. That, my dear friend, becomes an idol. And God meant that as well as the graven images when he says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Let's take care of that. So these are the ways of this man. And let me say this, we'll have to come to a close. We'll not be able to get on to the latter part of this today. But let me say this. God was now unfolding to the prophet Habakkuk not only that there was going to be an instrument raised up that God was going to use to punish the Jews for the sin that broke Habakkuk's heart, but God is showing Habakkuk some of the detail about this wicked nation that God is going to use. And God can use wicked people and wicked things to fulfill his purpose. Whenever we come back to this, we finish this section, this chapter, by seeing the woes that are going to come upon this man and his kingdom. But in the meantime, you could be reading this particular passage again and get the feel of it. But keep in mind this. God had not deserted his prophet. Habakkuk in chapter 1 was concerned. He says, Lord, how long am I crying unto you and you'll not even hear me for the awful sin in the land, in this country of mine? God did answer him. God showed him he was going to deal with it. But he was going to show him he would deal with it by a nation that was worse in his eyes than what the Jews were for their wickedness. And now we're seeing the detail of that. But Habakkuk can see beyond that. You remember the verse that we saw in this chapter earlier? The just shall live by his faith. Habakkuk is going to look beyond all the terrible happenings that are going on around him and coming to him. He's going to see the end of the story. And Christian, you can do that too. Even though your times are hard now, even though there are difficulties to contend with now, the last chapter, in a sense, has already been written. And it's in God's word. God has a gracious purpose for his people. And he's going to bring them home to glory. And the enemies that have set themselves against the people of God and the Christian church are going to be trampled underfoot in a coming day. But in the meantime, if you're going through a time of darkness and perplexity and despair, keep your eyes on the Lord. He hasn't deserted you. He knows what he's doing. He'll reveal his word to you. You'll have great comfort in it, as Habakkuk had, and as we'll see the next time we look at this. Keep your eyes on the Lord. Remember Peter? Whenever Peter saw the Lord walking on the water, he says, Lord, if it's you, bid me come to you. And the Lord says, come on ahead. Peter got out of the boat. And while he kept his eyes on the Lord, the storm was no problem to him. The storm was there, but it didn't bother him. But it's only as he took his eyes of the Lord that he went under. Keep your eyes on the Lord, beloved, no matter what pressures are on you to the contrary, and God will see us through. Let's bow together in prayer.